Session number 787, Brigadier Robert Bright, Reel 1.
Where were you brought up?
The first days I can remember were in Gibraltar during the First World War, after my father had been invalided back from the retreat from Mons. He wasn't passed as fit thereafter for service during the First World War, so he was GSO2, staff officer to the governor of Gibraltar until 1919, and those are the first days that I remember.
You would have been what sort of age?
I was born 1912, and we came back in 1919 when I was 7 years old.
And your so-called formative years, where were they spent?
Mostly with my grandparents, because after we came back, in 1920, my mother and father went out with the Buffs, which was my father's regiment, to India. And my mother thought that it was more important for her to be with my father than with the children. And the social aspect of life in those days was very difficult, different to what it is now, in that so many army officers and their families had a service background and certainly a professional background, so that there were nearly always grandparents who could look after the children. And it was not considered in those days that it was good to take children to hot countries such as India, because they thought that there were various medical risks of going out to India. So we were left at home with my parents. And my parents served abroad, while my sister and I went to our preparatory schools from my grandparents. My father retired in 1922 and came and retired down in Dorset, not very far from where we are now. And I went on from my prep school to Wellington, which in those days was much more of an army school than it is now, and it had an army class, and it was always assumed by my parents, because we were an army family, my grandfather, my father being in the army, that I would go into the army too. Like most adolescents, I revolted a little because I wanted to be an engineer, but I then decided that I could probably get the best of both worlds if I went into the army, and went into some technical corps in the army. My parents then wanted me to be a Royal Engineer, and it is for that reason that I went to the Royal Military Academy at Woolwich.
There's one thing that interests me. As a result of your being brought up to a goodish extent by your grandparents, did they come to be the sort of parental focus to an extent, and did your relationships with your parents become in any way... Well, did you have sort of split parents, if you like?
To some extent, yes. And I can remember well that when my parents came back in 1922, I wondered what they'd be like. Because being at a young age, I had almost forgotten what my parents were like, and my grandparents had, to a very large extent, taken the place of my parents. However, my parents being very sensible people, the normal family relationship was very soon resumed. And thereafter, I was brought up just as any normal child might be.
Did your grandparents' home provide you with a happy childhood environment?
Very much so, very much so. And they were very sensible people, my grandparents. They spoilt us somewhat, as grandparents usually do. But on the other hand, they brought us up very sensibly. And they took the place of parents very adequately.
How did you get on when you went to Wellington?
Very well. I loved Wellington. I enjoyed it very much indeed. Funny in a way, because I was not particularly athletic in those days, and the dormitory, which is what Wellington calls houses in other schools, was a somewhat athletic one, and therefore I didn't shine in any of the sports there. On the other hand, I was a good shot. I shot for Wellington College for 3 years, first in the cadet pair and then in the eight for the following 2 years. So I could hold my head up all right, but I really thoroughly enjoyed my time there.
What sort of scholar were you?
Average. Mm-hmm. That is to say, I was regarded as somebody who would be fully capable of getting into the RMA at Woolwich, which was quite a step above academically going into the Royal Military College at Sandhurst. In those days, you could almost get into the Royal Military College at Sandhurst with a headmaster's recommendation. That is to say that if you were given a character which made the military authorities believe that you were suitable material to become an officer, you could pretty well get into the Royal Military College at Sandhurst without any very significant any very significant educational qualification. Whereas there was no question, if you went to the RMA at Woolwich, you had got to pass the army exam at a sufficient standard to merit your acceptance into the Royal Military Academy at Woolwich. And to bear that out, they were always undersubscribed. That is to say that they never filled all the vacancies each term because they kept their educational standard sufficiently high that if only they had an acceptance limit of 60 and only 50 reached the required standard, then the term was only 50, as indeed was mine, about 50 when I went to the Royal Military Academy.
Would I be right in assuming that a high proportion of your time at Wellington was geared directly towards preparing for the entrance exam to Woolwich?
Latterly, yes. I would say that it was rather like schools are now, where they go to their O-levels, and in fact, we all did the same until we did the school certificate, which we did at about the age of 16 and a half. That was entirely common. There was no specialization until then. But after that, after you had got your certificate, then you did specialize to some extent, in that the army liked modern languages. I did German and French, and the army liked mathematics. I think you had to have English as a compulsory subject, as indeed you did to the universities, and I think you do again now. But it was fairly general, but I would say this, that if you were going into the army, you would not do Greek and Latin after you had got your school certificate.
When you were in your senior years at Wellington, did you ever seriously consider doing anything else other than going into the army?
Yes, I considered becoming an engineer. I've always had an interest in chemical engineering, if you like. If I hadn't gone into the army, I would have liked to have been a steelmaker. In fact, during my army career, I've had a lot to do with steelmakers, and I learned a great deal about steelmaking. And I think that that would have been my second choice. It might have been my first choice if it hadn't been for the economic situation in the early 30s or in the late 20s when I was at Wellington, let us say that, because it was, I made up my mind, the late 20s, when the economic situation was such that to go into any civil career in engineering of any sort was extremely precarious. There was very high unemployment. You might well do your apprenticeship or studentship with an engineering firm and find yourself without employment.
I wonder if you had a choice as to your career, a real choice. It does sound a bit to me as if you were sort of preconditioned and channeled into the army.
I would say yes. I would say I was channeled into the army. Left to myself, I might possibly have gone into either heavy engineering or steelmaking, possibly. But I never regretted going into the army, I'll put it that way. I never held it against my parents that they had channeled me into the army, because I thought they had done what was only sensible to do. If I hadn't been to some extent channeled by my parents, then I might have either gone into heavy engineering or into steelmaking.
You went to Woolwich in 1931, in January.
That's right.
Tell me a bit about your early experiences in the training course.
Well, in those days, of course, Woolwich was a fairly tough sort of place. You got chased from the moment you arrived until the moment you left. We used to regard the RMA at Sandhurst with some contempt because they appeared to us, rightly or wrongly, to have a very easy life. For example, we were never allowed at any time out of uniform unless we were going away on leave for the weekend. If we went down to Woolwich, the local town, or the cinema any other time, we had to go in uniform and we therefore had to behave as soldiers, and the eye was on us all the time. And you only had to put one foot wrong and you were immediately on extra parades and so on. They were very strict in those days. And the discipline was very largely carried out by the NCOs, who were the senior term at Woolwich. Again, unlike Sandhurst, at Woolwich nobody got a stripe or became an NCO until their senior term. And there was quite a rigid division between the snookers, who were the first term, and then there was the intermediate term, and they were in different companies. When you joined the RMA at Woolwich, you went into one of the two snooker companies, and the other two companies were the second term companies, and then the third term, the NCOs, were spread between all four companies. So that when I went to Woolwich for my first two terms, I was in four company, which was first a snooker company and then became a second term company, as they did on the second term. What time the erstwhile second term companies went back to being snooker companies. And then my third term as an NCO, I was put into was then one of the second term companies, which was two company. But if you work out how they change each term, you'll see how it went. The regiment was very strict. We did a lot of drill, and our drill was probably just as good as Sandhurst. We did a tremendous amount of riding, and as I happened to be a good horseman, I spent a lot of my time riding. In fact, I made up for my lack of physical prowess at things like physical training and so on by the fact that I was a good horseman and was in the saddle ride and that sort of thing.
These senior term NCOs you mentioned, did they have much power?
Yes. You meted out extra drills to the second and junior term, and you were very largely responsible for their barrack discipline. The officers didn't really have much to do with the barrack discipline side of the business. They, of course, meted out extra drills and other disciplinary measures when on parade, but your behaviour off parade was largely governed by the senior term, who were in fact the NCOs.
In your experience, did the senior term NCOs ever in fact abuse their power?
I would say not. I would say not. They, of course, took dislikes to some of their juniors, who may have perhaps been treated a little unfairly because they were disliked. But provided you didn't get yourself disliked, then you would get very fair treatment, I would say.
Now, Woolwich, as an academy, took entries only within rather special limits, didn't they?
Well, only academically. I don't think it mattered whether you came from a grammar school or from any other background. But on the other hand, as there was a certain academic standard required, it would probably be much easier to get to Woolwich from a school that, to some extent, specialised in producing a limited number of army candidates. For example, in my term, there were probably twice as many entrants from Wellington as there were from any other school. There were quite a few from Sherborne. There were several from Eton. But it tended to drop away when you got to schools which perhaps didn't specialise to any extent in producing entrants.
Yes, I was thinking not about the backgrounds of the recruits, but the regiments they were going into?
Well, in those days, the Royal Military Academy only normally sent officers to commissioned officers into the Royal Engineers, the Royal Artillery, or the Signals. That is what it was for. The Royal Military Academy was for those three specialised corps, because it concentrated far more on mathematics and things applicable to those corps who have to deal with such sciences as survey and so on, than the RMA at Sandhurst, which was really only concerned with the military arts as opposed to technical skills, which are also required in the specialist corps. Right.
Well, how did you get on with this rather specialised engineering-biased course?
Well, I enjoyed it very much, and I found it reasonably easy. I passed out of Woolwich just about halfway down, and if I had made a special effort, I might have passed two or three places further up, which meant I could have got into the Royal Engineers. The Royal Engineers normally were the top strata of the graduates from the Royal Military Academy. A certain number of the higher ones went into the gunners for family reasons, but in general, the Royal Engineers took the cream academically of the Royal Military Academy. However, after my first term at the Royal Military Academy, having observed the sapper officers, of whom we had a large proportion, I came to the conclusion that they were rather serious-minded, and I was quite a cheerful young officer in those days, or young cadet in those days. And also, that if I went into the Royal Engineers, I would then be competing for the rest of my career, as things were in those days, with the best brains in the army, because before the war, the allocation of places to the staff college, for example, were by corps. Therefore, if you wished to go to the staff college, which in those days was a sine qua non to reach lieutenant colonel or above, you would have to compete with the best brains in the army went to the Royal Engineers, whereas if you went into some of the other corps, you could have got in without any difficulty at all. For example, so many of the officers in those days in the cavalry used to leave after perhaps 8 to 10 years in order to go back to their family estates or businesses, that to get into the staff college from the cavalry was very easy. To get into the staff college from the infantry wasn't too difficult. To get into the staff college from the Royal Artillery was a bit more difficult. To get into the staff college from the Royal Engineers was extremely difficult.
Can you recall the processes by which you eventually chose the RTC?
Yes, because I always had two loves and two bents in my young days, really, which seemed to be diametrically opposed. I understood horses, and I was a good horseman, and I also was quite a good mechanic. For example, I built my first motor car in the workshops at the RMA Woolwich out of scrap, which I bought out of scrap yards while I was a cadet. And this was the sort of tuned-up motor car that was popular in those days and would now be known by the Americans probably as a hot rod. That is to say, it was made out of bits and pieces and it was given as high a performance as you could. My particular motor car was made out of bits of an Austin 7 in which I altered the springing and put two carburettors on it and built a special body, which I built out of, again, scrap material and so on, and painted it bright red and put a strap over the bonnet. And that was one of my interests. My other interest, oddly enough, as I say, was horses. However, it was quite obvious, even in the days that I was at the RMA Woolwich, that horses were on the way out. Although the cavalry were still horsed, and so were the gunners, practically entirely, it was fairly obvious even then that it was going out. I could have got into the gunners very easily because I had quite a distinguished uncle who was retired from the gunners and was then running their remount depot at Arborfield. I could have got into the cavalry because various of my father's friends were cavalrymen, and I could ride well enough to hold my own in the cavalry, but I hadn't got the money that would require, and I was not prepared to live on charity, although I would probably have got on all right. Nevertheless, I thought it was better to go into a corps in the army where private money was not required. And the tank corps fitted very nicely into this niche. It was a mechanical corps, it was a young corps, which appeared to have a future, and it was a corps in which the officers in general did not have much in the way of private means.
How did you find out all these things about the tank corps before actually going into it?
Because there was an instructor at the Royal Military Academy from the tank corps, as there always was, and I talked to him about it and asked him about it, and I also asked him if I wished to go into the Royal Tank Corps, could he get a commission for me? And he said, provided I was acceptable to the then inspector of the Royal Tank Corps, who was General Brigadier Laird in those days, that he thought that could be arranged. So he took me to see Brigadier Laird, and Brigadier Laird thought that I would be a reasonable cadet to give a commission to in the Royal Tank Corps. And so in due course, when passing out time came for my term, there was one commission offered to the Royal Tank Corps, which was the one I had.
Whilst you were doing your researches about the Tank Corps, did you get any feedback or impressions generally about the current status of the Corps within the Army?
Well, only that it was a young Corps, and that possibly it wasn't very highly regarded socially in the Army of those days. The Army was probably, before the war, much more socially conscious than it is now. There were good and bad regiments in the infantry, and the tank corps was regarded as rather a sort of unknown quantity.
But that didn't deter you?
No, not at all.
When you made your decision, did you actually get any criticisms of it from any sources?
Well, my uncle, who had been a distinguished gunner, was disappointed I didn't go into gunners. Some of my father's friends, who had been cavalrymen, thought I was very silly not to go into cavalry. But my father, who was a very sensible man, said, well, I could do exactly what I liked. I had gone to the RMA, partially, as we've already said, on family instigation, and I had looked at the Royal Engineers, which my father was keen I should go into, and I decided it wasn't for me, and he accepted that and said, well, he was perfectly happy whatever I did.
Did the subject of tanks and their use figure at all in any of the coursework you did at Woolwich?
Not seriously at the Royal Military Academy, other than we did tactics of all arms, which you do at almost all military schools or academies and so on. But there was no specialist interest in tanks at all. Such specialist interest as there was at the Royal Military Academy was geared towards the Royal Engineers and the Royal Artillery.
This is a tough question, but as regards the tactical use of the various arms, do you happen to recollect what kind of thesis was being propounded at that particular time?
Well, we used to do schemes on engineering. We used to have to lay out camps and that sort of thing, which was had definitely an RE background with such things as water supplies and how you laid out tanks and so on. We also had to do defences. We had to do things which were somewhat reminiscent of the First World War, putting down barbed wire entanglements and digging trenches and all those sort of things, somewhat reminiscent of First World War. We had to do problems which were applicable to the Royal Engineers. And then, of course, we did a certain amount of gunnery training. We did gun drill, and quite a lot of mounted training, although it was mainly horsemanship, was also probably allied to the kind of life one might have led as a young officer in the Gunners as opposed to a young officer in any other corps.
So the coursework didn't actually specify that this was the way in which tanks should be used?
Oh, no.
No. Well, you went to Bovington in the autumn of 1932. Exactly. What was the RTC headquarters at Bovington like when you first went there?
It was very much a family concern in those days. It was very like a regimental depot would have been. It was largely based on infantry organisation as opposed to cavalry organisation. We had companies, not squadrons, and most of the senior officers had transferred from other regiments, largely infantry. So there was very much the same sort of background as you might have found in an infantry regiment. And I would say it was very much a regimental background. We were the Royal Tank Corps, but we were quite small, and it was very like really joining, the depot of my father's regiment, the Buffs, or something like that.
Did you find the headquarters establishment well-built, well-established, with good facilities and things like
that? Yes, I would say so. By the criteria of those days, I'm sure you realise that the army before the war was extremely short of money as regards facilities. Although the army now has been cut down in size and so on, the facilities and the training aids and opportunities which are now available in the army were not available to us in those days because there was not enough money. You trained under strictly limited conditions because of the limits of expenditure which could be incurred.
Could you make this a bit more specific as regards RTC Bovington? I mean, what was there? Describe it as a sort of
base
for me.
There was an excellent school of the driving and maintenance school was first class. I doubt it's any better now, comparatively speaking. The instructors there were all extremely good instructors who had been in the tank corps probably for anything up to 20 years. They were dedicated people. They taught us how literally to take our tanks to pieces and put them together again to an extent which I don't think would be possible now with the far more sophisticated equipment that is now in the army. But as of those days, it was an extremely thorough training which we received from the bottom up. Rather more, I would say, on the mechanical side at that stage than on the tactical or operational side.
Who were the outstanding personalities when you were there at this time?
Well, the commandant of the D&M school was Lieutenant Colonel Clifton, who subsequently was my CO latterly in the 5th Battalion. And he, oddly enough, was one of the few transferees from the cavalry. He'd been a cavalryman. He had been another rank originally, and he'd got his commission in the cavalry, and he then transferred to the Royal Tank Corps. He was a good organiser. He was a fairly strict man. And again, the regiment was pretty strict. You were expected to behave well, both on and off parade, and you were expected to pay full attention to your instruction in the D&M school, which in fact I'd say we all did, because I think one of the things which perhaps was noticeable about the Royal Tank Corps in those days is that all the young officers who joined the Royal Tank Corps were very enthusiastic as regards the Tank Corps and as regards their profession, whereas one always gets in the army as a whole a certain number of dilettante officers who perhaps go into the army because they can't think of anything else to do. I wouldn't say that was so in the Tank Corps in those days at all. I would say the standard of the young entry in the Tank Corps was very high and very dedicated. The standard of the senior officers, unfortunately, as observed from us young officers, was not very high because a number of them had been people who had been transferred from their regiments because they had no future in those regiments.
Can you be a bit more specific about that? I mean, in what kinds of ways did what you estimate to be the lowish quality of the senior officers demonstrate itself?
Well, I would say
some examples,
to some
perhaps.
Extent, morally and ethically, if you like. Perhaps it's snobbish to say so. They weren't all by any means gentlemen at a time when most officers in the army were gentlemen. They weren't always strictly honest. And they weren't the sort of people which one could always look up to. I mean, a number of them were, but a number of them weren't. Whereas I would say that in those days, in a good infantry regiment, such as the Buffs, to which my father belonged, they would have been pushed out. They wouldn't have lasted.
Now, you're drawing conclusions at the moment, and there must have been some events, some evidence, some specifics on which those conclusions were based. What interests me is what kind of things happened to make you form those impressions.
Well, I think the way the young officers were treated, they weren't always treated fairly.
For example?
It probably didn't do us any harm, but we would be given perhaps blame for things for which we weren't really responsible. And allowances weren't always made for us, which I think in a better balanced society, perhaps, than we had in the Royal Tank Corps those days, would have allowances would have been made. I think perhaps as young officers we weren't as happy as perhaps you would have been in a good infantry regiment.
You said they weren't always honest. What did you mean by that?
Well, I remember after I joined my first battalion that an officer was posted in and we were told he was not to be given custody of the regimental accounts because he was not trustworthy. Now that for a senior officer is quite something.